You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good morning. You are tuned into Cambridge 105 FM, community radio for your city. Many thanks, as always, to Kevin Peters for the past 2 hours of music and chat. But now it's time for the holler and squaw of the latest Bums on Seats of the year. Normally, we'd be sitting down for a look at the latest cinema releases, but today we have a studio overflowing with regular reviewers as we introduce our top 10 films of the past 12 months. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me in the studio this morning are Dave Riley.
Hello.
Owen Baker.
Hello.
Emma Marchant.
Happy nearly Christmas.
Ed Elliott.
Hello.
And Mark Levisich.
Good afternoon.
The top 10 that follows isn't what we would consider the best films of the year, with over 10 new releases every single week, and when multiplied by the 52 weeks of the year, that seems an impossible, rather fruitless discussion. Instead, the next hour will be counting down our favourite films of 2013, which, if they were all bundled together into one super film, would have a trailer that sounds like this.
Spoil me so.
Well, why not? Who else am I gonna spoil?
Okay.
Actually,
one thing.
If I could change one thing about you, it would be for you to stop trying to change me.
You know that guy? I've never seen him before.
You think I should do a human interest story?
Can I be honest with you? I am bad news.
Calm down. I'm simply a customer trying to conduct a transaction.
Last chance, fancy pants.
Oh, very well.
How many in the air?
13, sir.
How many can I carry?
4, sir.
You really believe this story? Osama bin Laden?
Yeah.
What convinced you?
Her confidence.
I'd rather you were rude to me than the nice people who work here.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to help you find your son. That's why we're here. So, I've just got some quiet time.
You just told me all about you. One minute you're on top of the world, the next, that turns out to be a crook.
Sometimes I don't know. I feel like you're breathing helium and I'm breathing oxygen.
What makes you say that?
He is. A rambunctious sword, ain't he?
Mud. You got me mud.
He's coming out.
He's at school. He's better off there than hanging around here with you.
What are you doing, Saeed? He's going to make some money, Con.
Every Bums on Seats reviewer, and there are about 14 of us, supply their own favourite films of the year, and those lists formed the base metal of our top 10. But this year, just to try and shake things up a little bit, we also asked for some favourite movies from the staff of the Cambridge Arts Picture House. Many thanks to Sarah Bassa-DeMarc, Matt Roberts, Nashira Martez, Alicia Ropez-Rios, Jack Toy, Lawrence Anderson and Callum Burrell for their suggestions, which just added a little bit of spice to the final chart. So, without further ado, let's start at number 10. And to keep things moving along numerically, this year we've enlisted the help of the Count from Sesame Street.
Ah, greeting. I am the Count. One, two, three. Four, five!
The first film in our top 10 was seen by both critics and audiences as a tremendous return to form, though some audiences seem confused that that form wasn't supposed to be funny. In Woody Allen's Blue Jasmine, Cate Blanchett gives what is undoubtedly one of the performances of the year. Fragile, tense and bitter, she plays Jeanette Jasmine Francis, the fallen ex-wife to Alec Baldwin's high-flying city executive. Once her New York evenings were a rush of parties, her long, bright days filled with the illusion of being busy and doing good. But her husband's riches came from bribes and backhanders, and when the law finally catches up with him, Jasmine loses everything. Her only safety net is her adopted sister, Ginger, Sally Hawkins, a blue-collar worker with a line of muscle men boyfriends and a tiny apartment in San Francisco. This was in your top 10 of the year. Woody Allen, he's always been, since the 70s, moved between comedies and dramas. But even by his usual dramatic inclinations, Blue Jasmine is a bleak, bleak film.
It's bleak. It's very subtle. It doesn't pander to, easygoing tastes. I think what's so impressive about it, I put it right up there at the top three, and I'm kind of looking around at everyone else, kind of wondering why they didn't. What's so impressive is that in the character of Cate Blanchett alone, you're simultaneously having a figure that you're disgusted by, you feel sorry for, and are laughing at. And any film that manages to kind of construct characters, and it's not just her, I think Ginger in particular as well, is a really complex character, and her sort of right at the end of the film when she's reunited with Chili, you have very mixed feelings about that. Her son, her adopted son, that you see very, 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 very small time on screen, is a very complex character, and the ending of the film is incredibly dark. And I think that to combine that with a really acerbic wit, I mean, you can say it's not a funny film, I was laughing the whole way through. To combine that with the level of wit that it had, I thought was really, really impressive.
I'm bringing you in, Mark, here, because you weren't as convinced. I'm not going to have a naysayer on every single film, but... But at the time, I remember you were really looking forward to it. And when we drew up our list of best actors, actors, actresses, directors, so on, you didn't even include Cate Blanchett on your list.
I didn't. I did put Sally Hawkins on my best supporting actress list. I thought she's brilliant. In fact, I think pretty much everything about this film is brilliant. For me, I must be about the only person in the known universe that didn't get Cate Blanchett's performance. For me, it just didn't ring true in the context of the film. It's just one of those things I think you just have to chalk up to experience. It just wasn't one for me on this occasion. Everything else about the film I would recommend wholeheartedly.
Ed, do you feel that perhaps it's an extreme... I've actually felt it had more weight than a lot of Woody Allen's dramas have of late, even You Will Meet a Tall Dark Stranger, which has a moral... which is not a particularly good film, but it has a moral weight that sort of hits you quite hard at the end. I thought this sort of felt the step on from that. I was a little bit disappointed he felt like he had to tie everything up so neatly at the end. That reminded me that this was an American film rather than a French moral play or one of Eric Rohmer's pieces, in that she had to be responsible due to her husband's affair. She had to be slightly responsible for her own downfall. And I felt that, and that was... that tied things up too neatly and took some of the chance away from it by making it delivered it to herself.
I can see that, but at the same time, that delivered for me what the greatest moment of the film was, is when she goes and sees her son-in-law at the shop, and they both kind of have this moment where they wish they could go back. They wish they could live this lie, which for her you can see, but for her son I think is a really dark turn, and a really subtle dark turn that you can miss if you blink. And I think that you can't have that unless you have her sort of creating the downfall to some degree.
Are they better, last question, but are they better female characters than we've had in the past in Woody Allen? Obviously, he's written great female characters, but for the last 10 years, they've either, especially in even in otherwise fine films like Midnight in Paris, they tend to just shift between either Muse or Shrew. And here... there's a little tendency towards that, but perhaps he's saved by the quality of the performances, or relying on them, perhaps.
I think that could be argued. I think it's difficult to tell with Cate Blanchett and Sally Hawkins' performances how much is Woody Allen's writing and how much is them. I think that if you just approached it and saw these characters, didn't knowing it was Woody Allen, that I think that you wouldn't have any problem with it. I think that they're fully fledged characters. They have influences from all sides, and they're reacting in ways that don't seem one dimensional. So, you know, why criticize it, I guess?
That's my nature. Okay. Blue Jasmine is due to be released on DVD, though possibly not Blu-ray. Midnight in Paris never got a Blu-ray release. On February the 17th, Woody Allen's next film, Magic in the Moonlight, is another star-studded period comedy and is due for release in the autumn of 2014.
One, two, three, four, five. Six, seven, eight, nine. I love to count flowers.
2013 could have been called the year of Matthew McConaughey if that moniker hadn't already been taken by 2011 and 2012 and earmarked for possible use in 2014. But the increasingly versatile actor was at his shirtless best in Mud, number 9 on our top 10. Written and directed by Jeff Nichols, Mud is a modern Tom Sawyer, with Twain's adventurer recast as a lovelorn and sensitive teenager. Ty Sheridan plays 14-year-old Ellis, who with his best friend finds a boat abandoned in a tree by floodwaters. But the makeshift home already has an occupant, Matthew McConaughey's languid hobo known only as Mud. Emma, this was high up in your top 10 of the year. You've expressed a liking for Matthew McConaughey in the past, even when but this is a film of many, many strengths.
Oh, for sure. I wouldn't even. It's not really Matthew McConaughey. I felt this was Ty Sheridan's film when I went to go and see this. He broke my heart in this film. I just thought it was a luminous performance. I'm really pleased to see it in the top 10 because it's not a particularly big film, but it just was. I thought it was a great film. Beautifully shot, wonderfully directed, nicely cast. It personifies kind of, like you say, lovelorn teenage. It's not like I've ever been a teenage boy, but I think it does teenage years really well. But in kind of wrapped up, encapsulated in a kind of timeless, not over sentimentalised because it's not, but it might, it has a very timeless quality, I think. And I just think the performances from Matthew McConaughey to Ty Sheridan to, who's the guy who's the baddie in Superman? Michael Shannon. And Reese Witherspoon, all of them are really, really good in it, and it's just a lovely, lovely film.
I almost said Ned Beatty there. I thought Superman. Ned Beatty was the villain in Superman.
I would invite him if Ned Beatty was in it. I can't imagine who he'd be. But no, it's just a lovely, lovely crafted gem of a film.
Again, to a bit the same issue I had with Blue Jasmine. And I've read a couple of tweets suggesting a similar problem. It does wrap things up a little bit, and I think it betrays itself at the end, quite. Badly, and in a similar way to the Nichols' last film, Take Shelter. It is from Ty Sheridan's, it is from Ellis's point of view, and then we leave it so we know that Mud is okay. And then that, coupled to the fact that there's a gunfight at the end, which doesn't come out of nowhere but isn't necessary, turns an odd character turns a deliberately ambiguous character into more of a hero. I found those two decisions, especially the last one of seeing Mud escape, especially as there's a shot that lies to us, that shows us a corpse in the water, I found that find that disappointing. That was one of the reasons why it wasn't in my personal top 10.
Who else has seen it? Because I can't talk about it.
I agree a bit about the ending. I think the gunfight for me wasn't so much of a problem, because although it does make him into a bit of a hero, he's kind of the hero of the film anyway, so that didn't bother me so much. But the very final couple of scenes are, they're problematic. They're also bizarre. I mean, they really do seem out of kilter with the rest of the film. The only thing I would say, though, is that for all of that, you know, I don't know what the running time of this film is, but if it's 96 minutes or whatever, 93 and a half minutes of it are, for me, wonderful. I mean, really wonderful. I don't actually think Reese Witherspoon's character, more than her performance, isn't actually that great. But I think it's brilliant. I think it's also beautifully, it captures that idea of when you're a child, about how a summer seems to go on forever. And you know, that this is a very short space of time, really, and yet so much happens in these boys' lives that it's kind of, and I find it mesmerizing. And I also think the portrayal of particularly the father of Ty Sheridan's character is really interesting, because he's not how you expect he'll be. He's not the kind of just the sort of drunkard kind of wife and child beating man. It leans towards that all the way, and it never actually does that. And I really like that about it.
It is also a very, because it is a kind of portrayal of a dying way of life, this living on the river.
Yeah.
I found it. I almost look at it as a fable, so I didn't have a problem maybe with this overdramatic end or this overly neat ending. I saw it as. It has that kind of fable quality for me. So that's why maybe I didn't have the problem you did with the ending.
Okay, all right. You can pick up Mud on DVD and Blu-ray now, whilst Jeff Nichols' next film is intriguingly set to be a science fiction thriller called Midnight Special.
One, two, three, four, five.
The decade-long war on terror has been shadowed by a queasy cinematic running commentary. Films like In the Valley of Ella, The Messenger, The Hurt Locker have all chosen unease over jingoism, something continued by the number 8 film on our list, Zero Dark Thirty. Directed by Catherine Bigelow, from a complex and fast-moving script by Mark Boll, the film is a disquieting examination of the CIA's hunt for Osama bin Laden. Jessica Chastain plays CIA agent Maya, a patchwork character of numerous real CIA agents. A rookie at the beginning of the manhunt, just after 9/11, the film depicts Maya's determination and ethical disintegration as a decade of searching for the world's most wanted man seems destined to end in failure. Dave, I was quite surprised to see Zero Dark Thirty on a number of top 10 lists from the reviewers and Picture House staff. I thought it had a much cooler response than that. What made you want to include it? What made it one of your films of the year?
This is the one in my list. It edged out Captain Phillips because in the Tom Hanks versus Jessica Chastain battle, she won, basically, for her portrayal in this movie. It was, as you say, watching the disintegration of her moral, kind of ethical character as she's working away, hunting down these leads, but also some of the sheer ferocity she displayed. There's a scene where she's meeting with the heads of the CIA and all the department heads, and they're all, you know, this is just before the mission to go and get bin Laden, and they're all still showing significant doubts, and she just says, no, I'm not having any of that, and practically tears their throats out, saying, this is it, this is our chance, we need to go do this. And then you come down to, and this is where it parallels to Captain Phillips, you come down to like the best bit of the performance, and it's in the closing scene. And Tom Hanks had a very similar thing in Captain Phillips, but Jessica Chastain's breakdown on the plane is even better.
It's more interesting than Captain Phillips because Captain Phillips' end is great, but Zero Dark Thirty doesn't show her breakdown. It just shows her, if I remember correctly, it just shows her sitting
starts to appear before the camera. That was that moment of emotional intensity. I'm going to turn it over to Owen now because he's going to disagree with me about everything.
Keep it fairly brief, but Owen.
For all you said, you're not going to have a naysayer on every film. You are on this one. This was actually my worst film of the year from Spring Breakers, those two by a distance from everything else. I hesitate to say this, but I literally hated this film. I think not for the performance. Her performance is great. Some of the visual direction is fine, but the politics of this film is incredibly problematic. And Catherine Bigelow has tried to sort of get around that somehow in a really mealy mouth way by saying, I'm making a kind of study of these events rather than any kind of judgment. It's a 3-hour film where she's asking you to feel sorry for a woman who spends 10 years of her life doing a job and succeeds. And in any other film, if someone dedicates 10 years, or in normal life, if someone dedicates that length of time to a particular job and succeeds, they're the hero. They've cracked it. We're constantly being told, and then there was a sort of statements made about it, about how it doesn't say torture's right, but it definitely says it works. And you know, the way that she's tried to get around that is by having the pieces of evidence, the crucial bits of evidence they need, don't actually come out technically in a torture scene. They come out in a scene later on where they're being nice to the tortured person. And, you know, and people have used that a lot, but that's exactly how they use torture. Torture someone, then be nice to them and get the information. And I just think all the way through, it's lying to us, and it's saying, you know, it may not be saying but it requires you to believe that the war on terror and the hunt for Osama bin Laden are completely justified, and that it's saying some of the ways used to do that are a bit questionable, but that the fundamental war on terror is totally justified. And I mean, I'm not saying it's not, but I'm not prepared to just accept that at face value. And we're asked to accept a lot in this film. And it's just, I found it very, very disturbing.
I have to disagree. I think that's complete rubbish, quite frankly. Like, just because a film depicts something definitely doesn't mean that it's advertising it. And I think maybe you're saying that it is advertising it. I think that the cold portrayal, I mean, you can say that she's saying it's a study. It is a study. It's, you come out of the film cold, and maybe that's the reason for the cool reaction, that it's not an emotional film. It's about looking at individuals who are obsessed by something and being destroyed by it. You see the dual narrative of Jessica Chastain and America, kind of, and the American search for Obama, running alongside each other, slowly falling apart because they're so obsessed by something that, you know, they shouldn't be obsessed by. They become, you know, the search for Obama, and search for Obama, search for Osama bin Laden, and that. It's not depicting it as an sort of advertising that as a good thing. I think that it's completely it's leaving you to make your own decision. If anything, I think that it's through the character of Jessica Chastain that it's portraying it as something that's deeply, deeply wrong, I think.
Well, thanks for the Obama Osama slip. That's gained us the entire Fox News network, so that's fantastic. Zero Dark Thirty is, of course, now available on DVD and Blu-ray.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. I love to count flowers.
It's been a good year for strong original and contemporary British film. For Those in Peril, I Am Nasreen, Welcome to the Punch, and How I Live Now all offered fresh, sometimes startling approaches to familiar stories and characters. But it was A Selfish Giant, the number 7 film in our top 10, that has the unusual distinction of having made 3 bums on seats reviewers gently weep. The debut feature of Clea Barnard, The Selfish Giants takes place in the dispiriting environment of a Bradford sink estate. Debutante Connor Chapman plays 13-year-old Arbor, a hyperactive teen at Tearaway, happily excluded from school and determined to make a living collecting scrap metal. Everything he and his best mate Sweetie collect, strip or steal, they hand over to Sean Gilder's master scrap dealer. But the adult world they've stumbled into isn't going to treat them simply like children. Mark, I believe everybody who saw The Selfish Giant included in their top 10. What drew you to it, its strengths?
I think, as a country, Britain has always done social realism dramas well. And I think Clea Barnard is now carrying on a grand tradition of those kind of dramas, but making it feel fresh, vibrant and almost exciting at times. But there's also a huge depth to it. And if I wasn't one of those three that was counted in tears, then you can add me as a fourth, because I was also welling up by the end. Deeply emotional. Another couple of, in what's been a great year for child performances, a couple of fantastic performances from Connor Chapman and Sean Thomas, who give the film heart and soul. It never feels anything less than genuine. It's remarkable.
It's interesting that you say that Britain has the UK has a tradition of social realism. It has a tradition of fairly... I'm being unfair here, but a little bit uncinematic social realism compared to the neorealism of the Italian cinema and the French cinema. But I found this overwhelmingly cinematic at times, and in terms of the use of sound, that's what excited me the most. There was a mix of the avant-garde, there was a mix of the unusual, yes, in her approach as a director.
There's both extremes. There's the horse race scene with the cars following it, which is just dangerously thrilling. You're absolutely tense through the whole piece, but also then some of the scenes where they're out just in fields, framed by the backdrop of some of the cooling towers of power stations just out sealing cable, absolutely beautiful. You know, it's a fantastic slice of life portrait of the undercurrent of British society.
Well, The Selfish Giant is due to be released on DVD on January the 27th. It makes a perfect late Christmas gift.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Mums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. We are getting towards the halfway point in our end of the year film top 10 with the studio fit to bursting with Emma Marchant, Owen Baker, Mark Liversidge, Ed Elliott and Dave Riley. And don't forget that it's studio open day at Cambridge 105, so you can come in and peer through the glass and make faces and all sorts of stuff and distract us. Anyway, we've had numbers 10 through to 7, so now, fittingly, we're on number 6.
One, two, three, four, five, six.
The last 12 months have seen the surprising cultural dominance of Steve Coogan. There's not only been the brilliant Alpha Papa, a rare occasion when a TV character makes the leap to the big screen with all their faculties and humour intact, but Newsnight didn't seem complete without his occasional guest spot delivering withering sarcasm to a News International crony. But the surprising highlight was the number 6 film on our list, Philomena, a road movie that suggested a heartwarming Odd Couple film, but in fact delivered something far sharper and sadder. Written by Coogan, co-written by Coogan, and directed by the versatile Stephen Frears, the film stars Judi Dench's Philomena Lee, a strict Catholic who wants to find what became of the son she gave up for adoption 50 years earlier. Coogan co-stars as the journalist who, reluctantly at first, leads Philomena on her journey, the investigation taking both from the County Tipperary convent that took the child under its wing to the corridors of power in the USA. Emma, you were one of a number of people. Gavin was another who... I was rather surprised by put Philomena on their list. It's a fairly recent film, but obviously it stuck with you.
Yeah, without a doubt. I didn't see The Selfish Giant, but I can safely say that I wept almost all the way through Philomena, although I am an easy crier for sure. I saw it with knowing very little of the real life story, and actually if anyone's still listening who hasn't seen it, I would recommend if you can avoid reading about the real life story, then do so, because for me that it just worked so well as a dramatic piece. I loved it. Steve Coogan, I thought, was so much better than you would think he would be as Sixth Smith. I think I said at the time of my review, Judi Dench, you expect to be great, and she is great. She personifies Philomena. This story, which really, it beggars belief almost. It's such such an incredible story, and I just think they do it a real service by putting it on the screen. They do not over-sentimentalise it. It could have become mawkish maybe in the hands of someone else. I think Stephen Frears has a really good eye as a director, and I just think he puts it up there, and with clean, clear performances, some really lovely shots, and like I say, it just lets this incredibly touching story speak for itself. And I laughed and I cried almost simultaneously. And it's very rare that that happens in the cinema, and it has stuck with me. And I'm pleased to see it getting love. It seems to be anyway in the end of kind of end of year awards list, including, of course, the most important Bums and Seats.
Why, thank you. Does it get across the sort of... Mark, did you want to come in on this? You swung the microphone towards you. I wasn't quite sure. Does it get across the sadness and the anger that because the Catholic Church that is responsible for a lot of the situation the film depicts, does it gloss over that, or is there? Because this is the only film in the top 10 I've not seen. So
I think it does. It doesn't rush to get to that point. It certainly uses all of its running time to make those points. I would have to say that I think a lot of that depth comes in the last act, and you find out things towards that point. I think Dermot's point of not spoiling it before you go in and see it. That add a huge amount more resonance. I think it's also good in the sense that Steve Coogan and Judi Dench stay true to their own characters. So many films like this would end up with a sort of mawkish sentimentalisation of these two characters truly understanding each other by the end. And while they do to a certain extent, they remain true to their own principles and their own philosophies. And in particular, Steve Coogan as Martin Sixsmith is as unflinching in his principles at the start as he is at the end, but he's still... learned from the story.
I think there is anger in this film. I think I said this in my review at the time. There is anger in it, and it doesn't... I don't think it flinches away from that, but it also has in Philomena herself, like Mark just said, there is... You've got both sides of the equation. You've got Martin Sixsmith, who just cannot comprehend what has happened, and you've got Philomena, who, because she is a good Catholic, has the spirit of forgiveness, and it depicts it wonderfully, really wonderfully.
Well, Philomena is due out on DVD and Blu-ray and download via iTunes and all the usual channels on March the 4th.
One, two, three, four, Five! Ah, 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 ah. I love to count flowers.
The number five film on our list arrived in a flurry of award wins, an awkward change of heart from its director, and a reminder, once again, that the French have better sex than anybody else on the planet. Blue is the Warmest Colour is nothing more than a romance, but director Abdelhadef Kerchief deliberately depicts love's blossoming and fading in forensic and horrible detail. This isn't Amelie, but rather one of those films where you watch a fruit bowl disintegrate in fast motion. The quite brilliant Adele Exarchopoulos plays Adele, a student desperate for love but utterly unprepared for the rush of blood when she meets Léa Seydoux's shock-haired art student Emma. The two fall passionately in love. They almost devour each other in the film's numerous bedroom scenes. But life is full of temptations and pitfalls, and what seems the love of a lifetime soon unravels into heartbreak and loss and devastation. Owen, you were thoughtful about the film when we reviewed it about a month ago, but you've in messages since have become increasingly, it has stayed with you, hasn't it?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I think it's very hard to see films, particularly nowadays, and that sounds really old-fashioned, but particularly nowadays, without knowing a bit about the hype and stuff and the stories that have surrounded them, and I think to some extent that's to the detriment of this film. I think If you went into this film completely cold and didn't know anything about it, I mean, there'd be shocking things about it. But also, I think it would... I think too much of the judgment comes from knowing that, you know, the director was difficult and there's extended lesbian sex scenes and stuff like that. But I think your analogy that it's like watching a fruit bowl sort of disintegrate in speed up is sort of very true. And I think that the most important thing about this is that there is explicit sex scenes throughout the film. But they are nowhere near the most explicit thing about the film. The most explicit thing about the film is the kind of just the intensity of the personal relationships. And I think if you're able to see the sex as a kind of an analogy for the intensity and, like you said, the sort of devouring of each other in that relationship, I think the film works really well. And there are close-ups of people's faces in this film which are... you're aching for them to finish because it's so raw and so intense. And I just have to mention that the performances, particularly by the lead female Adele, is just unbelievably powerful. I mean, just extraordinary from start to finish. And she is at once kind of astonishingly ethereally beautiful one moment and then genuinely kind of ugly the next. And that in itself is extraordinary. It really is quite a powerful film. I don't think it's perfect. I don't think it's absolutely without fault, but it's very close. It's very close. I think it's a very powerful film.
What do you think about the criticism that's been levelled at it, and it was levelled at when we reviewed it a month ago, quite rightly by Hannah, that it sort of puts the females, the two female characters, and the idea, and rather uncomfortably perhaps, if you can read this into it, the idea of the lesbian lovemaking on a pedestal a little bit.
Yes.
In that we have a director who, to my mind, and I've not liked his previous films, whilst I adored this one, in that seems to consider, it might consider himself a teacher and the audience as pupils. And he has teachers in the film who say as much, yeah. And he has a teacher at the film, as Hannah pointed out, who says that female... And again, if you take the teacher in the beginning classroom scene as speaking for the director, then I'll go to Mark here, because he has something to say. But I'll look at you, Owen, but go to Mark.
Yeah, that
perhaps is being a little bit simplistic in its... I don't think it faults the overall film itself, but it makes me feel slightly uncomfortable. Mark?
Yeah, I would agree with that to a certain extent. I have to say that if it taught me anything, it's that everyone in France has sex with the lights on, and that made me feel slightly uncomfortable myself. But for me, it was the emotional rawness of the scenes, particularly the one where they're in the cafe towards the end, which I think is one of the scenes of the year. Absolutely astonishing. I feel slightly sorry for Léa Seydoux, who's yet again been fantastic in a film and is going to end up slightly overshadowed by Adele Exarchopoulos' breathtaking performance. I don't think it would be a lesser film if you excised the love scenes, to be honest. I think they don't necessarily add as much as they could do. I don't think they're essential in that sense. It was fascinating sitting in the Arts Picture House watching this film and looking at a slightly uncomfortable audience for the length that they went on. They are only about 10 minutes of the whole 3-hour running time.
But do you think they gave it a bigger audience? I haven't seen it.
Only briefly. It opened at the Arts Picture House to a sold-out weekend, pretty much, I believe. It was gone a week later. It comes back sporadically, but it's. I think, Pete, the word of mouth on the film is going to be, well, it's very long. There's a lot of crying.
There is no escaping. It's the longest film I've ever seen in the cinema without an intermission. And I was getting a DVT by the end of it. So, you know, if you're going to lose 10 minutes, fair enough. But... And I think there are films in the past couple of years like Weekend, which have also worked as well in terms of understanding a relationship, regardless of the sexual orientation of the people involved, but have maybe done so in a more concise manner than was achieved here.
That's true. I felt, again, there have been many naysayers about the length. I feel that the overwhelming ferocity of the length was somehow just was. I can see. I don't know. I didn't feel it was. Anyway, as you said, blue is the warmest colour had its run at the Picture House, but it is coming back. I think it's there next week or something. It comes back for one afternoon. So if you haven't seen it, it is very long. It is also
Take a cushion.
It is one of the it is quite a brilliant film.
One. Two, three, four. Wonderful! Oh, I love the beer.
After Marvel Studios pulled off the seemingly impossible by blending all their big screen superheroes into the more than satisfying The Avengers, they now seem to feel confident enough to loosen the belts of their costumed heroes and let it all hang out. Now that the new audiences love them, they can start to have fun. Iron Man 3, number 4 on our chart, was the boldest summer blockbuster in years. Directed by the well-respected Shane Black, the film took Robert Downey Jr.'s arrogant, shell-headed hero and divested him of his powers and powerful enemies. Instead of clunky CGI battles, Black and co-writer Drew Pearce surrounded Tony Stark with a B-movie thriller plot full of wit, a kid assistant who wasn't acute, and a love interest who gave as good as she got. Plus, in Ben Kingsley's The Mandarin, Iron Man 3 delivered a villain that delighted everybody hoping that spectacular special effects could, for once, sit alongside interesting characters and genuine surprises. Oh, and this is the only blockbuster in our list. It was the only blockbuster I had in my top 10 list yesterday. It's one of the only films I went to see twice, actually, probably because it wasn't 3 hours long. Yes. But it's quite brilliant, I thought.
Yeah, I think it's really very good. I mean, they've dispensed, I think, perfectly amicably with Jon Favreau as the director of this, well, sort of writer and director of this, and got in Shane Black, who wrote, amongst other things, the Lethal Weapon films, I believe. And you can really see that kind of buddy movie sensibility here. But I think it's to the credit of the Marvel Studios, really, rather than particularly anyone involved specifically in this film, that they've just managed to make slightly more. I mean, this is by no means a kind of French all sitting around a table talking about our feelings kind of film. It's just slightly more intelligent kind of blockbuster movie. Lots of special effects, all of that. Some sort of charismatic performances, good use of comedy. You know, to be honest, nothing that shouldn't be eminently achievable with this kind of budget, with these people, but so often isn't. And in this film, you know, like you say, it's the only blockbuster in our list, and it's the blockbuster in our list because it's significantly better than any of the other blockbusters that have been out this year. Not that any of those are terrible, but this is just a very well put together film with some very charismatic performances, and sort of nothing. There's nothing to criticise about it. It's not mind-blowingly revolutionary, but it's just perfectly good. It's, you know, I thought it was very effective and I enjoyed it a great deal.
Emma?
I'm just going to say very quickly, I think the thing that makes this stand head and shoulders above everything else is Robert Downey Jr. And that's why I say Marvel were very lucky getting him at a point where obviously he's at a point in his life where he can be relied upon, and his Tony Stark is, I mean, really, to be honest, the Avengers felt like it was more Iron Man than anybody else, and there's a reason for that. It's because he is just freaking great in it.
But then this film does often come to mind. I mean, Don Cheadle is given an awful lot to do. He's given some scenes that Tony Stark would have done in previous films.
I'm not undermining anything else. I'm saying it is a real... His performance just stands head and shoulders, I think, above every other Marvel performance. There, I've said it.
Mark, I believe at the time when we reviewed this on the show back in the summer, you said it... I might be misremembering, but you said it was... better. You enjoyed it more than The Avengers. You thought it was the high point of... Which is not to dismantle The Avengers, but this is the high point of Marvel's cinematic adventure so far.
To me, The Avengers still felt like an origin story, whereas this is another episode in Marvel's continuing quest, and for me, it's still the best of either phases of the Marvel movies that have been released. I think anyone who saw Kiss Kiss Bang Bang would relish another chance to see a Shane Black movie with Robert Downey Jr. in the lead, and we got it, and it was as good. The only point I would disagree with Owen about is that Star Trek Into Darkness was terrible.
Some of them were terrible.
Yes, there was at least one terrible blockbuster. Yeah. This wasn't it. This was head and shoulders above the rest.
Dave, did you want to say something quickly?
I was going to add one bit of criticism, was that the ending was just like the other two. It descended a bit into CGI madness, but they did save it by bringing in the other characters and not just having him.
Sure. And they did wrap everything up into a neat bow, and you have a feeling, other than the two Avengers films that he's contracted for, this is Robert Downey Jr.'s final.
Yeah, and it was a great final film for him.
And it gives Gwyneth Paltrow something to do, which is, again,
very important. Very we all love seeing her on our screens, me in particular. Much as Colin Farrell.
I forgot. It's difficult to keep up with all your numerous dislikes.
Hates and loves.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are listening to the Cambridge 105 FM Community Radio for your city, and this is Bums on Seats, running down our top 12 films of the year. Don't forget that when we are off the air at 1 p.m. in 15 minutes' time, we make way for Saturday lunch, which is just the beginning of an afternoon of Christmas scheduling, which I'm trying to find. There we go. Arts Roundup is at 2, it's from 2 to 3 o'clock, followed by Radio Dante from 3 to 4, and then from 4 to 6 is 105 Sport, with the latest from, I'm going to show my lack of knowledge here, Cambridge United, is that a football team?
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Cambridge United, and other football teams. From 6 to 7 is Jason Allen, and then from 7 to 8 is Club Global. From 8 to 10 is Two Tone, and the day finishes off at 10, from 10 to midnight with the Graham Park radio show. That's all to come from 1 p.m. but here on Bums on Seats we're just about halfway. Well, we've got three more releases in our countdown of the year's most captivating cinema releases. Heading into the top three, we'll discover some old friends and some familiar arguments.
One, two, three. I love to count flowers.
It's not often the Hollywood love story lingers. The first kiss is imprisoned on hours and hours of celluloid, but to have a three-film dissection of a single romance is remarkable. Our number three film of 2013 is Before Midnight, Richard Linklater's bittersweet finale, perhaps, to a love affair that began with 1995's Before Sunrise and ended in a cliffhanger of sorts in 2004's Before Sunset. Ethan Hawke's Jesse and Julia Delphi's Celine are now married with twin girls. They are at a crossroads. Jesse misses his young son, who lives in America, while Celine's government job isn't all she dreamt it would be. They are now in their 40s, and their relationship has entered its 18th year. Ending a long summer holiday in Greece, they have a rare day to themselves, and slowly buried tensions begin to rise to the surface. Emma, almost everybody out of the reviewers had this film on their list someplace or other. What were you a fan of the other two before you came to this?
No,
you weren't, were you?
I wasn't.
That's right.
At all, not in the slightest. I hated Before Sunrise so much. I didn't even watch Before Sunset until literally the day before I had to go and see this to review of the film. And I thought I'd better watch Before Sunset. So I watched Before Sunset and found that much more pleasurable Before Sunrise. And I thought Before Midnight was the best of the trilogy. Could be, of course, because I am watching it as a 40-year-old married mother of children. And they are, at this point, we are at the same point in our lives. And I thought the depiction of a married couple who've been together for a long time was realistic. It was sometimes difficult to watch. It was painful, but it was also beautiful in terms of their relationship. And I thought Julie Delpy was brilliant. I thought Ethan Hawke was great. It really worked for me. I didn't think I went in with underwhelmed expectations, let's say, and I came out overwhelmed with enjoyment for it and feeling really affectionate for these people, which I hadn't felt before. And I just think and I'm a big Richard Linklater fan, so it's a really, really lovely, simple film, but with layers.
Mark, you want to come in here, because again, you hadn't seen any of the first two, had you?
As we documented at the time, I watched all three of these in a day. It left me desperately craving stale fruit by the end. I wanted to leap on another 9 years and see what happens next, whether we ever will or not, only time will tell. This again for me was also, as much as I enjoyed all three films, this is the standout of the trilogy. The naturalism and the complexity of the relationship, when they come to what seems to be a culmination of a good day in a hotel, all of a sudden spirals into a massive argument, genuinely feels how those arguments happen in real life.
Mm-hmm.
It is a near perfect depiction of a couple who've been on an incredible 20-year journey, and one that you know, is not afraid to have huge long takes of people sat in a car talking to each other, and you know, has had fantastic input from Ethan Hawke and Judy Delpy into that process. You know, it genuinely leaves you craving more.
Emma, the final point, really, does it do a good job? I mean, what you've been saying is, I don't have very much interest in any three of these films, and this film was way off my, I didn't even consider it. It's just not to my taste, rather than I think it's particularly bad. Do you think it deals with it as films have been the fairy tale of love sort of sliding into reality,
yeah.
Whilst keeping some sort but finding a different reality, in different magic rather, in that reality. Do you think that's a slightly fair way of putting it?
I think it's a very fair way of putting it. I think this is a very real depiction. I do remember when we were reviewing it on air, and you felt that maybe Julie Delpy verged towards a shrewish in this. I think you were saying that you didn't feel like they were very sympathetic towards her in the film. I didn't feel that. I just think it is, like I say, it is about as real a depiction of a couple after 18 years that I've seen on screen, particularly from Hollywood, and I applaud it for that.
Okay. Well, obviously, Before Midnight can maybe be found on DVD, there's probably a box set, isn't there, in time for Christmas. Watch this marriage dissolve over the Christmas dinner. To be fair, it doesn't quite dissolve.
It doesn't dissolve at all.
No,
Toby.
No.
One, two, wonderful! Oh, I love the beer.
The huge success of the number two film on our list is all the more remarkable as it's constructed out of ideas it simply shouldn't work. Predominantly state-of-the-art animation, it is anchored by a brilliant dramatic performance from a renowned comic actress. It made believers of 3D naysayers and took the blockbuster roller coaster ride into a new filmmaking territory. Gravity, the latest film from Mexican auteur Alfonso Cuarón, is a triumph of technology, talent, and sheer filmmaking bloody-mindedness. The film is a journey from A to B to C to D to Earth. When a disintegrating satellite sweeps past and destroys a NASA mission, the only survivors are George Clooney's veteran commander and Sandra Bullock's scientist rookie. Floating 372 miles above the planet, they've only the slimmest chance of survival, and that small chance rests entirely on finding a functioning escape pod on one of the now abandoned space stations floating about. Dave, this film has been the top of many top 10 lists across the UK that have been published recently. I was quite surprised actually it didn't make number one here, but what was so magic about Gravity? It's been summed up in that word on occasion.
It's a combination of everything you've said right there, the performances, the sheer bloody-mindedness that has been put in it. Was it 8 years in the making? Something like
4 years in pre-production, I believe, 8 years of the idea. And everything.
8 years in total. I've been working on stuff for 8 years that's never going to be as amazing as this. One thing I'm going to mention, because you haven't, is the music by Stephen Price. When they released the trailer for the film, they added sound effects in, because otherwise it would just sound weird because it's quiet. But all you've got in the actual film itself is you hear noises when they're in contact with the spaceships, because that's the way noise travels, through vibration. But when you don't, you've got this fantastically, almost depressive soundtrack at times where it's the sound accompanying the debris cloud when it's first coming towards them in the first 2 minutes of the film, and it's like, this isn't going to be good. It's just a ramping up the bass and oppressive. I just love this movie. Over to Emma.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I was surprised it wasn't number one as well, but that's good. That leaves some tension for the last bit. But I was going to say, yes, this film has everything. Cinematically, it is gorgeous. It is just beautiful. The performances, particularly Sandra Bullock, I found really touching. And it's a thriller. It's a thriller with it. It just really works. It really works. You can see that on the faces, can't you? It's cinematically brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I really enjoyed the film. I'd be really interested, because I went with three other people, all of whom were fairly literate in film, and we all came out with the same reaction. We all enjoyed it, but I'd be interested to see if particularly the last half an hour, I found very repetitive. That it's like problem resolution, problem resolution. You almost felt when they, spoiler, when they crash land, that when she gets out, she'll be eaten by an alligator or something, because they'd had so many of these, like, oh no, something's happening, and then, oh, we've sorted it out, that it kind of just dwindled out after a while.
I didn't have a problem with that. Though I can see that as an issue, but I felt that the fact that the film was really about her having to surmount everything that was inside her and everything that was going on outside, this wasn't the reason why this wasn't in my personal top 10. And I actually came out relatively angry, is I felt it damaged all the goodwill of the, because it is an extraordinary achievement, and most of the film is astonishing. But the best scene in the film is the scene where she's drifting in and out of consciousness, and the radio is filling the Soyuz spacecraft she's in. That got across the strangeness of space, the awful strangeness of it. I felt the music, I felt, was overbearing and at points idiotic, and I felt the end with the coming back to the Earth's atmosphere was just so over the top. It was like it was a film where suddenly realised it had to appeal to the American mall crowd.
I think good on it for doing that. I think it gives you really good payoff at the end of a really dramatic film. Sorry, Toby, I disagree.
Sorry, Owen, yes.
I don't want to sound like an edgelord. I really enjoyed this film. I think it's really good. But there is a scene in the middle, quite near the middle, where she comes, basically when she first gets onto a spacecraft after this horrendous disaster, and she gets out of her spacesuit and she's in a kind of fetal position floating in a doorway. And it's a beautiful, beautiful image. And for me, it summed up one of the very slight problems I have with this film, that it's held a little bit too long for me. And it's kind of got, it feels like a director going, this is a beautiful image, and there's a lot of beautiful images in this film. This is a really beautiful image. And I just felt like the realism was lost. Because although I know this film is ludicrous in a lot of ways, I mean, there's some issues about where space stations are in space that really are mental. If you start thinking about it, it doesn't work at all. That didn't matter to me. But that scene for me, I just think, yes, she's relieved to be out of space, but she would have been quite a lot more professional and urgent than just floating there in a fetal position, which looks amazing, but it's slightly flawed. And I think that ties into what you say about the ending, where it suddenly gets all a bit kind of diehard for me, and that was a bit of a problem, I think.
Okay, well, we have to move on. I can see horrified faces and agreeing faces, and nothing if not contentious, which is good.
One. I love to count flowers.
In a year which has been bookended by Steven Spielberg's Honourable Lincoln and Steve McQueen's heartbreaking 12 Years a Slave, our number one film could seem an almost childish view of American slavery. But whilst Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained may be garish and loud and comical, it's threaded with a genuine fury of America's horrific past. The film is the second time, after Inglourious Basterds, that Tarantino has rewritten history using the violent rulebook of exploitation cinema. A mix of spaghetti western and gore-soaked blaxploitation, the film stars Jamie Foxx's Django, a slave risking the southern states in order to track down his kidnapped wife. Mark, this was number two on your top 10 of the year, so presume it struck a chord, especially as it was all the way back in January now, I think.
It was. I think if you're not a Quentin Tarantino fan, this is probably not going to convert you. I think if you are, you will relish every single one of the 170 odd minutes that this represents. It's for me up there almost with Pulp Fiction in terms of the quality of his output. Everything about it, the quality of his script, the dialogue, that brooding sense of tension which he always builds in his films, which comes to the head in the end of the dinner party scene here. We haven't got enough time for me to list all the superlatives I think this film represented. I'm just going to finish with Amazeballs.
Okay. Emma?
Yes, wholeheartedly agreed. Leonardo DiCaprio is brilliant, Jamie Foxx is brilliant, Christoph Waltz is brilliant. Obviously, you know, I love the fact that later on in his career, kind of Quentin Tarantino has taken Christoph Waltz and this kind of, you know, art house Austrian actor and opened him out to this whole new audience, and he is brilliant. He throws so much at this, and it was, I think, 170 minutes of just pure cinematic entertainment with a great soundtrack, which Tarantino does so well.
Just to come back very briefly, I think the beauty of that is that I think Samuel Jackson was Tarantino's muse for such a long time. Bringing in Christoph Waltz as his new muse allows Samuel Jackson to do something entirely different.
To be like a cameo,
Tom character that he portrays in this is such a departure. But you know that and Leonardo DiCaprio's performance, I think at one point he actually smashes a glass in his hand in real life. His hand is there bleeding and he's still acting because he's so in the performance. It's just taking that quality on another level.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, we have to wrap up, I'm afraid. Otherwise, we haven't got enough time. Sorry, Dave, sorry. Otherwise, the news will crash over the top of us. That is our last show of 2013. Well, not quite our last show, just our last live show. To make sure we mop up some of the last releases of the year, we've also recorded a special podcast, Bums on Seats, with the reviews of Saving Mr. Banks, Nebraska, Frozen, Anchorman 2, and The Hobbit, Desolation of Smog. It's quite a contentious hour and a half. This new show, which should be released on Monday, the day before Christmas Eve, making it the perfect listening for wrapping up those new presents, the last few presents. We'll be back on 12 p.m. on Saturday, the 4th of January, with a show which features The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, American Hustle, some news on the Cambridge Film Consortium, possibly 47 Ronin and Mandela. We'll wrap up with film that was just out of the top 10, shame, some of the music from Francis Ha. Please stay tuned for Saturday lunch, but from everybody here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.